I'm not seeing anything on my end. Say, oh, okay.
Hello and welcome to the Major Film Reviews podcast. I'm your host, as always, Nathan Major, joined by my co-host, Angel Ruloff. Say hello, Angel.
Hello, Angel.
The running gag that won't stop, even though it stopped being funny about three episodes ago.
I'm running that into the ground. Just...
are you sure you've never written for the Big Bang Theory in your life?
What did I do to be insulted like this?
Because you're certainly experienced at running jokes into the ground.
I mean...
Sick Ben, oi, 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 lads, etc. Anyway, ho, etc. It's Christmas. Well, it's...
Moving swiftly on like the snow in a blizzard.
Yeah. It's the 14th of December, so it's near enough to Christmas. And we're feeling in a holly jolly mood, aren't we, Angel? Aren't we, Angel?
Yeah.
That's the spirit. We like Christmas here at the Major for Film Reviews podcast. Well, I do. I can't speak for my co-host.
I'm very much a Halloween person. Halloween is... Well, Samhain is my festival. Christmas, Yule, Saturnalia. It's... alright. But I'm out for Halloween.
For our listeners who don't know, Angel is Dutch Italian, and I'm aware of a kind of tradition in mainland Europe where they tend to open presents on the Christmas Eve instead of Christmas Day, because I know that my Swedish friend does that. I was just wondering if that's a thing in the Germanic region, shall we say.
The Germanic. Ugh. ignoring the Germanic region. We have Sinterklaas or Bakusavond, which is like presents evening. Mm-hmm. So there's Saint Nick's Day on the 6th of December, which is an interesting festival. Very racist, very colonizing. Anyways, we do not have enough time to unpack.
Holly jolly. Holy
yes,
jolly.
Holy jolly. So the Eve of Saint Nick, we basically just give each other presents. It's mostly a children's festival. I say festival. What's the word I'm looking for? But yeah, it's a like a children themed aimed at event. So kids are the ones that get a gift. It's kind of like a Secret Santa thing where we. Well, I don't know if they still do it. I hope they still do it. But part of the tradition is we kind of make our own sort of like, it's kind of like a gift hamper thing. You get like a few bits and pieces and you kind of make the gift box. It's mm-hmm. like paper mache, very arts and craft. And you just kind of give that to friends, family. Predominantly children. It's usually kids gifting towards other kids and adults gifting kids. There's like a parade usually with Saint Nick and his friends. Yeah, I'm gonna call it what it is. They're slaves. But I think in recent years, instead of it being black slaves, it's just a all-round mix of people that are his quote-unquote friends helping him. The history behind Saint Nick is quite interesting.
Don't say we don't offer educational content on this podcast.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just going to info dump on this.
because it is worth kind of exploring, because it's always interested me how different countries celebrate Christmas differently. Like, I know I think it's Spain. They tend to celebrate Christmas more on January the 6th, which is the last day of Christmas.
Yeah,
that's Spain. Yeah. Obviously, there are certain countries that celebrate it more on Christmas Eve, like the Swedes, as I previously mentioned. I think that might be all over the Nordic region, so Finland, Norway, and Denmark as well. And obviously there's different things in Germany and Ho not Holland, the Netherlands, sorry. Such a cumbersome name for a country, the Netherlands. You have a perfectly good name, Holland, and
Yeah.
anyway, never mind.
Cool. It's kind of like the
Mind
official name and then just what we call ourselves, kind of.
you, I can say nothing because I'm from England, which is on the island of Great Britain, which is a part of the country, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So, you know, we can hardly talk about strange names and changing names and, you know, different things because we're just as bad as we frequently are over in the UK. But one thing that doesn't change from country to country, perfect segue, is the country's love of festive films, and we've got a hamper full of festive films to talk about today. I've been watching a lot over the last few weeks, posting about on my website, and I'm watching one again later. I think I'm going to watch Home Alone later. I haven't watched that in a few years. But we're going to talk about our very favourites today. And I'm hoping our lists differ. We haven't told each other our lists because we don't tend to, otherwise it would sound very pre-planned and very workman-like. We
And it's
like to
also
go
the thing of
on
like
the
the
podcast.
reaction of, oh my God, you like that film.
Well, I would say that most of my films are fairly uncontentious. There are no real curveballs in that. My one usual curveball is I sometimes add in Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer, which only I seem to remember. Have you ever heard of Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer?
Is that the one where it's got Sylvester Stallone
No. No, Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer was an animated film that used to play on Cartoon Network every year when I was a kid. And it's about a grandma who goes out on Christmas Eve and takes a fruitcake out with her that has reindeer nip in it. And it distracts Santa's reindeer, so they fly down and hit Grandma. And then Santa sort of kidnaps Grandma and takes her back to the North Pole so she can recover. And then Grandma gets amnesia and doesn't remember who she is. So, like, her grandson has to search for her, eventually finds her at the North Pole because an elf finds his letter. And then his evil cousin Mel wants to take over the shop and sell it to some big department store. And then they try and sue Santa for running over Grandma.
That sounds pretty wild.
It was, and like I seem, it is a real thing because it's on IMDb. I have a copy of it somewhere on my computer. It's an actual real thing. It's mental, and I remember looking forward to it every year on Cartoon Network. I would sit and watch. I would look through the TV listings every week in December to catch the first showing of Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer again, and then. I mentioned it on my Christmas playlist uploads that I did a few weeks ago because I seem to be like the only person I've ever spoken to who remembers this film. Do you have any kind of weird childhood Christmas films that you remember but nobody else really seems to?
Oh my God. Yeah. I can't believe I forgot. There was a Christmas special of Power Rangers, the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
Right.
Oh, how did I forget about that? But I'm not entirely sure if it was an actual film or like a standalone special TV episode. I'm gonna have to Google that. Oh my God, how did I forget? Because I had that on tape and I loved it so much. I would watch that all year round. How did I forget about that? Because like my favorite character in Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, apart from the Green Ranger, I just wanted to be the Green Ranger. Is it Alpha? I want to say Alpha, or is it Alfalfa? Alfalfa might have been a different film.
I never actually
I
watched the
just
Power Rangers.
remember the little robot going, ay, 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 ay. I'm just like, I love you. Right, hang on. Power Rangers Christmas film.
Because it seems like everybody has kind of childhood memories, and every now and again, someone will offer up this kind of weird memory of a film that nobody seems to remember, but they can like describe vividly, and like I can see like full scenes of Grandma got run over by a reindeer in my head, and I can describe them vividly, and nobody remembers anything about this film. And like there's been a few examples of this. Like I remember one of my exes once told me about a film which I then got them on DVD called Annabelle's Wish, where there's a cow that wants to be a reindeer. But they spent like the first few years that I knew them trying to convince me that this was a real thing, that there was a film that Dolly Parton had a song in the soundtrack of, which is another weird thing. But there was a film where there's a cow that wants to be a reindeer, and that's the crux of the Christmas film.
Okay, so I found it. Right. And it's Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, Alpha's Magical Christmas, and it was the special for season 2. And it was a non-canon direct-to-video Christmas special.
One of the more memorable holiday specials, up there with the Star Wars holiday special, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, I watched the Lego Star Wars holiday special. In November when it came out. That was quite funny. There was a scene in it where like Darth Maul is just like the upper half of Darth Maul crawling around. That made me laugh.
Should I be laughing?
But I think it was an attempt to rectify the memory of the original Star Wars holiday special.
Mm.
But, did a decent job of it because it had that kind of signature Lego humour that seems to win so many hearts.
I think I've seen like the Lego movie and I don't really remember it.
It is a pretty memorable film, so I'm quite surprised that you don't remember it.
I mean, I remember like the Lego cat thing.
I think the one pervading memory, every time I rewatch the Lego movie, I always get the song Everything is Awesome stuck in my head. Because I think it is one of those songs that's designed to deliberately sort of stick in your head.
It is, yeah.
But, and I also really like the Lego Batman movie.
I haven't seen that one yet, but I've heard things about it where apparently it's like, to quote my friend, it is incredibly gay. It is so gay.
Oh, very gay.
Have you seen it yet? But, how have you not seen it? It is so gay.
But Batman is an inherently gay character. An inherently homoerotic character.
He's always been very, very... I'm just trying to think of a polite word of saying it, but like,
especially in the Joel Schumacher films. Maybe. Yeah. Who can forget the bat codpiece from Batman and Robin?
I'd rather forget, please and thanks, just like David Bowie in Labyrinth, where it's just like, I didn't need to see that.
I watched Labyrinth for the first time last week. I hadn't watched it until last week. But I have now, and there will be a review in my new book coming out in the new year. Plug-o, please buy my books. That will be in there, along with a scathing takedown of The Conjuring, which I thoroughly did not like. And I also watched Countdown last night because it was my fiancé's birthday and he wanted to choose the film, and he chose Countdown, which is, it's not a feature-length adaptation of the British game show Countdown. In fact, in hindsight, I think I would have rather watched an hour and a half of Countdown, the TV show, than an hour and a half of Countdown the film. But those will be in the book, and the Christmas stuff will be on my website. So we shall get on with the Christmas stuff, because Christmas is great. Isn't it, Angel?
Don't make me lie.
Isn't it, Angel?
Please don't make me lie.
you even have a Christmassy name.
I mean, it's... All Seasons.
For Christmas Day, Angel.
I mean, I guess. I mean, having said that, I do have a very long list of, because I'd compiled a list of like all of the Christmas films that A, I remember, and B, that I actually enjoyed. And it's, I'm surprised at how many I've got on here. I'm just like, oh, I'm not that big of a Grinch when it comes to Christmas films. After all, there is something, I'm not opposed to the warm and fuzziness of films. I mean, that's kind of why I'm a bit of a Disney brat, but like, there's something of a theme with my Christmas films, I think.
This was something that I've talked about in the last few reviews that I've done, is that we tend to give more slack to Christmas films because we want that warm and fuzzy feeling by the end, which is why I think Christmas films in particular hold a special place in our heart, because most of them tend to be feel-good films that give us that warm, fuzzy feeling that we want when we're about three glasses deep into mulled wine and full of Christmas pudding. And which is also why quite a lot of them tend to be not as challenging as other films. That's something that I've noticed as I watch more Christmas films, is they tend to be more popcorn film than something that would challenge you. There are some differences, of course. There are some Christmas films that I would say hold up alongside any film ever, along with my top pick for a top Christmas film, which is in my personal top 25 films of all time, but we'll get to that later. But because of their nature, we tend to kind of, they tend to have more positive reactions in our brains, I think, specifically towards Christmas films, that we don't tend to give other films.
Yeah, I think it's quite a, I don't know, it's like for the season as well, because things are so incredibly cold and so incredibly dark, you kind of need Christmas films to have that little bit of a serotonin boost. Yeah. You need something that is comforting, that will actually give you some form of hope and, you know, a sense of happiness and joy, that thing of,
I remember going like, to
community and camaraderie.
I remember going to watch Last Christmas last year at the cinema, and I remember thinking at the end, I really enjoyed it, but had that film been about any other season apart from Christmas, had that had the same story but not about Christmas, I would have hated it because of its sugary nature and because of how kind of contrived it was. But because it was Christmas and it had the kind of typical Christmas trappings, and it was a nice story, and it really kind of made your heart swell, I gave it a pass and I really enjoyed it because of that. But had it been like a Valentine's Day film, had it been based around Valentine's Day, I would have positively hated that film. But because it was a Christmas film, I enjoyed it.
Just out of curiosity, are we going to do a Christmas film special, maybe? Because I wouldn't be mad at skipping that, because I am struggling with any kind of Valentine's films I enjoy.
We won't be doing a Valentine's special, no. Oh,
God, thank you. Because if there's one thing that I'm very open about being a Grinch towards Christmas, but Valentine's Day is something else.
I quite agree.
I am all jingle bells, and like, I will put on a Christmas sweater if anyone's got a spare one, but Valentine's Day, I'm just like, no. I'm a Grinch with Christmas. I am something else with Valentine's Day. If there's one festival I dislike more than Christmas, it's Valentine's. Oh my goodness. Okay, yeah, Christmas is not my most disliked festivity of the year.
I have a curious feeling that Valentine's Day is what it is because of greeting cards companies.
Yeah.
Because they're like some of the most sly retailers on the market. Like, all they have to do is make a card and people do the rest, and then it becomes its own thing.
Yeah, because
I'm
it's
willing to
very
bet.
much that there seems to be a lot of pressure for couples to like do the whole thing of like get cards, get flowers, and get gifts, propose, go on holidays, and just spend money they don't really have on something that you should be doing any time of the year. It's one of those things where I don't fully know if it's just a me thing or like a neurodivergent thing, but like one of the reasons why I dislike Christmas so much is because of how incredibly capitalistic it's gotten, where people feel so awful not being able to give their loved ones the gifts that they feel that they deserve or need or want. And I know this year especially, because people are in lockdowns and people are having to be socially distant and everything, there's a lot of parents that I know that are really worried for their kids that they're not going to be able to give the kids a good Christmas. And it's just, how far have we gone from just Christmas being family orientated to I need to get presents and I need to host an incredible event, and it's very keeping up with the Joneses kind of feeling.
I
And that I
agree.
don't like about Christmas.
The more I kind of get, the older I get, the more I look forward more to seeing my family, and more, I look forward more to the Christmas dinner now. That's my highlight of Christmas, because it's like a it's a very rare thing, especially now that I've moved away. Because when I go back at Christmas, it'll be the first time I've seen my parents in 2 months. It'll be really nice to spend Christmas with them and have Christmas dinner. And also I'll get to see my grandparents, who I haven't seen since I moved. I don't think I've seen my nana and grandma. So that'll be nice. And that is what I look forward to more. And I've also found that I look forward to seeing other people opening presents I bought them than opening my own presents.
I think one of the reasons why I prefer having Christmas over in Italy is because of it's still pretty much family orientated over there, where it is just, there's Christmas mass and you open your presents up in the morning or whenever you've got time, whenever you want to kind of thing. It's pretty relaxed, and then it's just food. It's just very much a thing of you're there to spend time with your family, getting to know them, being in their company, enjoying
I feel
the
like
simple things.
between Christmas and New Year is just a never-ending parade of food, isn't it? Because when I was at home last year, we did a obviously we had our Christmas dinner on Christmas Day, and then we'd have a kind of buffet kind of dinner on Boxing Day, where we'd have a few family round and things like that, and we'd use up the rest of the turkey, and we'd have sausage rolls and pork pies, and then on New Year's Day we'd have another sit down dinner with like another big spread, and then we'd have another buffet on New Year's Day. So, and even like a few times between them, we've had a meal on like the 27th or the 28th, when my dad used to work, because he used to work Christmas Day, so sometimes. We'd have a Christmas dinner on like the 27th as well, so Dad could have like a full Christmas where he had a day off. So like for me, those are the times that I look forward to. Obviously, I appreciate the presents and everything, because that's always nice when people buy you things they've put thought into and kind of things that you want, which is always nice. I think it would also be nice. It's a lot nicer for couples with children as well, I understand, because obviously the magic returns when you've got kids, because kind of the Santa Claus becomes real again for the kids, and that's nice, because obviously I've got two goddaughters, and another one of my best friend had a kid a few months ago, so I've kind of gotten them presents that they really like, and it's nice to know that like we've this. They're still looking forward to it as much as we did when we were kids, and that's the nice bit of growing older with Christmas, is that you can see young people enjoy it like you did.
Because for me, I always preferred like I said, the Christmas, spending Christmas in Italy than I did like in Britain with my British family, because the British family was very shallow, materialistic. There was always that competition between my cousins and I, where it's just like, oh, what did you get? And I'd be just like, well, I got pajamas and socks. Oh, well, I got a new DVD player and all this fancy stuff that costs an absolute fortune. And I'm just like, I really like my pajamas. I really like my socks. Like, look, it's got a cute pattern. And I'm very simple. Like, you buy me socks and I am happy. I am one of those people where it's just like, you've got a £5 voucher? Great. I'm grateful. But other people just like, oh my God, a gift card? You didn't put any thought into that. And I'm just like, but they had to pick the card out and just like, yeah.
I absolutely, the older I get, the more I enjoy buying presents for people, because I'll kind of, it'll sometimes be something I think of year round. Like, I'll have this idea in like January, and then when it comes to December, this idea has festered for a whole year, and I finally bought it, and it's sat under the tree, and I can't wait for them to open it because I put so much thought into it. One of my favorite things I ever did, this wasn't Christmas, it was a birthday. But when my dad turned 60 a few years ago, he won't thank me for saying that, for the whole world to hear, but never mind. When my dad turned 60 a few years back, I kind of compiled in secret this box of things from the day he was born. So I got like what was number one in the charts. I got it on a 7-inch vinyl. I got the film that was number one in the box office the year he was born, a coin from the year he was born, like a match day program from a rugby team that he liked from the year he was born, and then I typed up a document where it was like all of the events that happened in 1958 when he was born, and I put it all in a gold box and like gave it to him on his birthday, and like he said that that's the best gift that he's ever gotten, and that was like that made all the effort worth it for me,
Yeah, because it
just
was
to hear
highly
that.
personalized and very well thought of. You know, you put a lot of time and effort into that, getting things that you know that he enjoys.
And it was a lot of research too. I mean,
Yeah,
he didn't.
a lot of time and effort.
I don't think he necessarily appreciated being reminded how old he was, especially when I researched what was number one on his birthday. I discovered that the singles charts were only active for 3 years by the time he was born. So had he been born like 5 years earlier, I wouldn't have been able to find what the number one single was because there wasn't a chart. And what was number one on his birthday was Connie Francis, which he really didn't like, because Connie Francis is seen as like this like pre-war era singer, so she's like really.
So it was very much a reminder of his age and.
Very much so, yeah.
Hello, everyone. Just me from the future, as is relative to this podcast recording. I mean, I'm not in the future if you're listening to it. I'm actually in the past. But anyway, there were some technical interruptions during our podcast recording. After all, that makes sense. We were interrupted for 6 months worth of podcast recording, and in this, the final recording of the series, we were interrupted a grand total of 3 times, all for deliveries. So this is me just bridging a gap between one interruption and the resumption of the podcast. I hope you're enjoying it, and I hope you will continue to enjoy it. And I will pop up, bridging the gap again twice more. Enjoy the show. Bye bye.
Welcome back to the Major Film Reviews podcast. Sorry for those technical gremlins there. But mind you, gremlins are appropriate, it being Christmas and all.
Yes.
I haven't watched Gremlins. I'm going to, though, and I'm going to watch it in the next week and review it for my website. So keep an eye out for that. And keep an eye out for all the reviews I have coming up to Christmas. I've managed to finalize my top 10, which is now a top 5 because 2020, much earlier than I usually have. So that's, and I need to write it yet though. And I'm also doing a second annual Major Film Reviews Awards, which have been considerably difficult this year. So I've opened it up to every film I reviewed, which Here's a little side note for how my reviewing works, is that I tend to make a note of every film I go and watch in the cinema. So I have on my phone notes of every film I have watched from the last 3 years. I didn't carry that habit over into everything that I've reviewed during Corona times. So I've completely lost track of everything that I've reviewed. So I'm going to have to go through my entire website again. I've posted nearly 160 times this year. So I'm going to have to go through 160 posts to get a list of the films I've reviewed in order to do awards. So I hope those that read my stuff appreciate the effort I go to for that.
I didn't realise it was so many, because I know, like, with you reviewing previous films, sort of like revisiting films, watching films that you've not seen yet, 160, that's... Yeah. I'm impressed.
I was... My awards post from last year was my 200th post, and I'm now on 366. So, no... that's 166 in the year. It'll probably be close to 170 by the time or maybe even more by the time the year's out. Even though the cinemas have been closed, I have not closed myself for business. I've carried on because I not had films to review and stuff to watch, I would have gone insane many months ago. But I watched 100 films in the cinema last year. So there was a lot to choose from in terms of the top 10. I think my list was about 40 by the time they closed for the second time. So, and some of those re-releases, especially after the first reopening. So like all of my top five from the first quarter of the year, which is kind of reflective of the year itself, I guess.
Yeah. With things like Amazon Prime and Netflix Originals, and you know, there's a few other streaming services that have been doing originals.
Yeah,
it's not been as quiet as I think we were kind of worried it could be at the beginning of the year.
Definitely not, but it does worry me because I am considerably worse at keeping up with streaming than I am with keeping up with cinema releases, because I haven't watched most of the major streaming releases. I haven't watched Enola Holmes, which I would have watched if it was in the cinema. But that's the way that film viewing is going to go in the next few years, especially over the next year or so, because most releases are heading to streaming as well as in the cinemas, which I think the cinema has to catch up with soon. And not work so much as pushing back against it as working with it. That's the only way they're going to survive at this rate, sadly.
It's just having to adapt and just, move along with the times as best as possible. I mean, the reasons why I keep fighting for more subtitle screenings is so that more people that need subtitles can actually access films. And it's just one of those things of you could get a larger income. If you subtitled it, because that's a lot of people that they're missing out on.
I mean, you should work with the resources you have. Times was in years past that the cinema was the only place you could see new films. Yeah. Now that's changed, and cinemas can't pretend that it's still the only place to see films anymore. Especially as people's home media, the thing you watch it on, as TVs get bigger, the need for cinemas gets smaller because we can watch all the new films at home. Our screen's big enough to enjoy it. We've got 4K Blu-ray players, you know, so cinema has to work with streaming as opposed to work against it. Otherwise, it's going to go the way of the dodo within a few years, and that'd be really sad. Because I think the thing is, even if the option is there to watch a film at home, I think a lot of people would still use the cinema if the choice was there. And if it was more accessible, then people would choose to go to the cinema. But because they're not being given the choice, you're taking opportunity away from them. It's like you say, when it comes to subtitled or audio described films, that's a feature that every Netflix film has. That's a feature that every Amazon Prime thing has. It's not a feature of every cinema film. So you're taking that choice away from people. So people are forced to go to Netflix and Amazon Prime because they can't get it from you.
So one of the things that I really like about the cinema is the whole experience of it, of like meeting your friends and, you know, like waiting in the lobby, being all excited to, you know, see the film and, you know, the whole waiting to buy the popcorn and everything. And for me personally, lack of subtitles affects how I view the film. And it's also the way that things cost at the moment. Things have become so incredibly expensive. It's one of those things of if I want to go to the cinema, I have to try and coordinate with my friends if they've got time on like that one day a week to see that one film that's subtitled, if it's any good and if it's actually an adult film, because majority of the subtitle films are geared towards children.
I mean,
odd time where it's like Monday at like 12 o'clock and it's just are you free on Monday?
I would wager that most people feel the same about going to the cinema, not the subtitle thing, because that's a specific thing, but about going to the cinema. But one thing that puts them off is A, the expense, because why would I pay £15 for me and my partner to go to the cinema when I could pay £7 a month to, well, sorry, what is it now? £9 a month for Netflix to watch something on there. And I could go to the shops and get a bag of sweets for £1 and not have to spend another £5 at the cinema. And also I can watch this film whenever I want and not have to go to the cinema at like 8 o'clock at night when the only screening is, and by the time I get out, it's 11 o'clock. That's something that cinemas are way behind on, is that their window of opportunity is far too small, which is even truer for the smaller releases that people are still interested in, but they don't go to because you put them on at like 9 o'clock on a night when nobody wants to go to the cinema to start a film unless it's like a new release, like at that time. Like, I don't even like starting a movie at home after 9 o'clock, let alone going to the cinema.
I mean, there's two exceptions that I can think of to that, and that's Star Wars midnight release.
Yeah.
That is just an event in and of itself.
Well, that's what I said, the new release at midnight, and that's different.
Because that's part of the fandom, isn't it? Just like there with other people that are really engrossed in that fandom, being like, oh my god, let's see what this film brings. And the other exception is BTS, when they release a cinema release, because again, it's that fandom thing of, god, I didn't know you liked BTS, and okay, let's see what the lads have gone up to, and you know, apparently this is going to happen, and we've heard this rumour, and like, ARMYs will make an absolute event out of it. There's so many stories where people have like made little gift bags to give to other fans at the cinema. It's like complete and utter strangers just being like, hey ARMY, here's a gift bag just because we like the same thing. And
you're just describing BTS as the lads has put this image in my head of BTS at a Wetherspoon somewhere.
I mean, that's, I wouldn't put it past them, to be honest. Like, I'd take him to, like, maybe not Spoons because, you know, capitalism. Yeah. but I'd take him to a local pub and be like, yeah, have a pint of Guinness.
Anyway, we have gone very far off topic, as we usually do.
Yes. I'd take them to a local pub for a Christmas meal.
Take them for Christmas dinner. I found out a little kind of factoid recently. This isn't about Korea, but it's about Japan, so it's about East Asian culture. That apparently KFC is a really popular Christmas Eve meal in Japan. It's so popular now that you have to order it weeks in advance. Were you aware of this at all?
I don't think I was, no. Fascinating. Yeah. So I think that I'm aware that KFC and McDonald's and other places, they do like Christmas specials.
The origin of it comes down to capitalism, as most things do. The origin was that there was a promotional campaign in Japan one Christmas that said, eating KFC on Christmas Eve is really popular in America. So Japanese families kind of latched onto this and thought, right, we're going to make it a tradition too. To the point which now, X amount of years later, you now have to order it weeks in advance because it's so popular.
I know in Japan you can get married in McDonald's.
I mean, that doesn't surprise me because Japan is a place. There seems to be this kind of underlying weirdness to most Japanese culture that I really find endearing because it's so kind of nice. Because it's, I mean, not all of it is innocent weirdness, I must say, because some of it is about schoolgirls on subway trains. But there's also this kind of underlying weirdness that's kind of wholesome too.
Yeah. Again, going back to the warm fuzzies, where it's just like, this is really so sweet and wholesome. Just faith in humanity somewhat restored.
And again, Japan is somewhere that I've always wanted to go because I've always really liked the idea of Japan and Tokyo and things like that. And it just looks really nice and the people seem nice and friendly. But anyway, off topic once again, as we all are, that we should put that on a t-shirt.
Yeah. Moving swiftly on.
the podcast with tangents galore.
Yeah.
So let's get down to the nitty gritty.
Yes.
Christmas films.
Yes. Shall we do our top five first, or shall we quickly go through the liked films?
Let's go in order. So we'll start with some honourable mentions, and then we'll go, like, I say my faith, you'll say your faith, and we'll go down the list and talk about them.
Yes.
So have you got any honourable mentions that don't make the list but almost did?
The ones that almost did? There's a few, actually. But I'm going to go with, like, my top one, and that's the Beauty and the Beast Enchanted Christmas special.
Oh, wow.
Because Beauty and the Beast is one of my favourite films, and they did a Christmas, and I'm not entirely sure if I actually prefer the Christmas version over the actual film. Because it's Beauty and the Beast. And, you know, warm fuzzies of just, like, Adam is literally a beast and he is such a grump and I relate to him because, grr, Christmas. And then Belle is just so wholesome and optimistic and hopeful and so naive. And just like, look, the magic of Christmas. And they get along.
It's one of those direct-to-DVD Disney sequels that kind of cut corners in every department, and it shows, isn't it?
It's cut corners. Oof. It had Tim Curry in it. How dare you?
having Tim Curry in it is not a matter.
Oh my god! We go back to Tim Curry again. He's just, how many of my favorite films is he in? I'm gonna have to do a list on my own. Anyways, moving swiftly on. I think you were trying to say something.
Any other honourable mentions?
Nightmare Before Christmas. It's that crossover film. Yep, Halloween and Christmas. Perfect. The Snowman. Animated. It's an animated short. It's like 27 minutes. So, is it a film?
It's so melancholy, isn't it? It's really melancholy.
Yeah, but it's so beautiful. So beautiful. I love the artwork and just, you know, walking in the air.
But music. On a negative note, it did give us Alan Jones, so I will never forgive it.
I mean, it's a negative to you. I love that song.
It's a lovely song, but he didn't sing it in the film anyway, so.
Yeah.
It was another one called Peter. I think it was called Peter.
Hmm.
Yeah. Let's go with Peter.
Yeah. But sticking with names, another one of an honourable mention for me is Arthur Christmas.
Oh, I love Arthur Christmas.
Again, animated. Love it.
Yeah. And it's not only animated, but it's a really good studio too. Because was that an Aardman one? It was, wasn't it?
I think it was, yeah. I didn't write that.
It was an Adam co-production, I think, with an American studio. And yeah, it's so lovely. I think Arthur Christmas is proud of it. My honourable mentions. It's one of those that I always forget every year exists, and then like it pops up on my recommendations around Christmas time. I'm like, oh yeah, that's a film that exists and that I really like. Let's watch that again.
Yeah, Arthur Christmas is a Christmas staple. It's just one of those Christmas films where you kind of have to watch it. Another one that I've added to my must watch repeatedly during this time of the year is Klaus.
Yeah,
it is actually pronounced Klaus. Okay, because my brain is just like, it's Klaus, but dude, is it pronounced Claus? Nah. And then it's just like Klaus, Claus, huh? What?
I've always said it as that's how it's spelled.
Yeah. And then there's Santa Claus with what's his name?
Are we talking Tim Allen or Dudley Moore here?
Tim Allen. It's just... just so grumpy and just like, I don't want to do Christmas. And yet, you know, warm fuzzies, just...
My honourable mentions would be quite similar. I think Arthur Christmas would be one that you just reminded me of. Klaus as well, because I watched that last year and I just fell in love with it because the animation's so beautiful. And the story was so nice. The Grinch is one for me, which I kind of see that a lot of Christmas films are perfectly imperfect. So there are things about The Grinch that make it like imperfect, but I still love it because of its kind of realization of the Dr. Seuss world was so well
is
thought
that
out.
The recent animated one or the Jim Carrey?
The Jim Carrey one. Yeah,
that's actually my top five.
I found the Benedict Cumberbatch one to be very sterile and uninspired.
Sterile. Wow, what a word!
It was very designed by committee. It didn't have that whimsical feel that Dr. Seuss needs to wear.
I've not actually watched the animated one yet.
It's on Netflix now.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen it and I've almost clicked on it, and then I watched the Jim Carrey version.
But I would recommend you watch the Jim Carrey one instead, and for that matter, the original 60s short as well, because that's also very good. Then there's also Nightmare Before Christmas as well, which you've already mentioned. Batman Returns, that's a Christmas film. It's very good.
Also, Die Hard. That is a Christmas film. I watched it recently.
Dad is in my top five.
See, so. I watched Die Hard recently because there's the whole argument thing of like, oh, but it's an action film. It can't be a Christmas film. Try and like pick it apart. What is it? It's a guy that's trying to go home for Christmas. The only reason he is in LA is because he's trying to go home for Christmas to be with his family for Christmas. The purpose of him being there is Christmas. It is a Christmas film.
Hello, just me again. We were interrupted a second time here by my doorbell this time and not Angel's. So this is me bridging another gap from the future, but also the past. Ooh, spooky. Yeah, back to the Christmas films.
So let's get on to our list.
About Die Hard. I remember that.
Yes, Die Hard. Die Hard. We will get to that because it's on my list, so we can talk more on that later. I actually had a more difficult, is it a Christmas film, is it not, one. Did you see my review of In Bruges this week?
I haven't. I want to read that because I do love In Bruges. So
you have seen it then?
I have seen it. I love it.
Good. Right, so my correspondent, hello Ian, by the way, sends me films to review. And he sent me this thing, it was a Christmas film. And I don't think I agree with him. I think it's a Christmas adjacent film. It happens at Christmas.
But it could be set at any point.
Exactly.
It went over for like Valentine's or Easter or just a random day, it'd work.
I think there are certain parts of the plot where it's cold, and obviously the fog adds to it, so it has to be at a cold time. But that doesn't necessarily have to be Christmas. It could be in January, and the plot would be the same.
Yeah, it could have been like a New Year's Eve
thing. As I said in that review, a Christmas film doesn't just have to be set at Christmas. It has to be a film in which Christmas affects the plot. Or it has to be a film where if you take Christmas out of it, either the film wouldn't work or it wouldn't work as well. Because I fully accept that Die Hard would work if it wasn't at Christmas, but it would, but not in its current form. It would lose something. Like John McClane could be going home during the summer, but because he's going home for Christmas, it has more of an emotional impact.
Yeah.
That's the crux that makes it a Christmas film, because Christmas affects the plot.
But it's also the thing of, like, he doesn't have any real purpose to just sort of visit randomly during the summer, whereas going home for Christmas, like I said, it's that deeper emotional value thing. It's a higher purpose. It's something he needs to go home for Christmas.
I think there's a defined difference between a Christmas-adjacent film, something that happens at Christmas, and a Christmas film. Another good example is Iron Man 3. Part of that happens at Christmas, but you'd be very hard pushed to call Iron Man 3 a Christmas film.
Because that's something that could happen just throughout
the year. It could work just as well on any day of the year. A Christmas film can only work at Christmas. There are some films that could work if they're not at Christmas, but not as well. Like Home Alone. Home Alone could work if they were going on a summer holiday and they forgot him. But because it's Christmas, it adds to the emotional impact.
Yeah. Especially when he's talking to his neighbour and it's the whole thing of like, oh, well, you know, because his neighbour had fallen out with his son. It's just like, well, it's Christmas. Like, just talk to him. Just invite him round and just get it over and done with, kind of thing. So for the Christmas setting, that advice kind of make sense.
Yeah. There is a, because the thing with a Christmas film is there is no concrete definitive edition of what is and isn't. So I think different people have different ideas as to what it is. To some people, a film that just happens around Christmas is a Christmas film. Whereas to me, it has to be something a lot more substantial to make it a Christmas film. Yeah.
Like this Nightmare Before Christmas, the reason why that's a Halloween film and a Christmas film is because it's set during both periods, and both periods are very integral to the storyline.
Yeah, it's not just that it happens at Halloween and Christmas, it's that Halloween and Christmas both have an impact on the story.
It's like it's got a purpose.
Yeah, and like there's different Christmas settings in Batman Returns as well, which is a kind of a contentious one too. I'll concede that that's a Christmas film, but there are parts to that that make it a Christmas film. There's another one that Ian, my friend who sends me the films, said that he thought First Blood was a Christmas film because there's a Christmas decorations up in the police station, which, like, obviously that's just Christmas adjacent to me. That's happening at Christmas. It's again, First Blood would work any time of the year.
So what are your opinions on Edward Scissorhands being classed as a Christmas film?
I've never seen Edward Scissorhands, so I don't know.
Ooh.
Is my honest answer to that. I'm not the biggest Tim Burton fan, so I've never been in any rush to see what are defined as his classic films. I've watched his Batman films because I'm a Batman fan. I watched Sweeney Todd because I really like the musical, and I think he did a good job of that. But apart from that, I've never been in any mad rush to see any of Tim Burton films. I think his visual style, while it is striking and somewhat original, well, not really even original, it's just very repetitive once you've seen more than one of his films. It's something stops being odd when it use it over and over again.
Yeah,
there are only so many times I can watch Johnny Depp pretend to be a weirdo. Is my point.
I am wounded. But I also see your point. Because
it's a bit like how Captain Jack Sparrow lost his shine after a...
Yeah, that got a bit repetitive. I mean, how once many are there?
Once,
like
you've
five,
seen that, once you've seen that five times, it's like, you know, we already know what he's like. It's something that works. It works more the less you use it. Less is more.
Yeah, yeah. Keep it minimalist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah.
AISS.
I'm just going through my list. It's like, which ones have I mentioned? Because I've got a few that have, like, the exclamation marks next to where it's just like, yes, these films, I love them, but, like, that there's other films that I kind of want to mention, which is, like...
Let's get on to our lists, then. So, yeah. I shall start us off with my number five. And my number five is one that's probably on a lot of people's number fives list, because it's one that... I've realised it's a lot more contentious than I thought it was. My number five is Elf. I thought, when I first kind of mooted the point of doing Christmas films, that Elf was one of those films that's universally beloved and everyone loves it. But apparently, not so much. And I think a lot of that is to do with Will Ferrell, which, to be fair, I can understand your... some people not being fond of Will Ferrell, but I love Elf. Elf is, I get the arguments about Will Ferrell. His shtick is very repetitive, but it's one of those things where when it works, it really works, and when it doesn't work, it's excruciating to watch.
It kind of does work for Elf. It's not. I'm one of those people where it's just like
I think Elf.
The only reason why I'd watch Elf is Zooey Deschanel. That's basically it, I think.
I think Elf.
She's the only thing that I really remember, apart from, it's crazy. Or, like, you know, just Buddy shouting about Santa Claus. He's just a bit too loud and obnoxious for my.
Loud and obnoxious is just the right side of endearing to me. It's just endearing enough than Will Ferrell's usual shouting and screaming. I think it toes a very...
There is an innocent, wholesome quality to Buddy, and it's not that bad, but I'm one of those people where it's just like, no, thanks.
I think it's one of those films that toes a very fine line between being too much of Will Ferrell's normal act, but it manages to mix in just the right amount of Christmas sentimentality. There's just the right amount of it in there to make the amount of Will Ferrell bearable. Like,
I think if it was any other setting, it'd be an awful film, but it's the Christmas element, like, that kind of...
It's what I said about Christmas. It's because it's Christmas, it's endearing. And I think the biggest thing that endears Buddy to me is that first scene in New York when he arrives and he's waving at the guy that's trying to hail a taxi, and like he goes into that cafe with the neon sign that says "World's Greatest Cup of Coffee" and just says, "Congratulations, you did it," and eating the chewing gum off the railings, and it's those kind of scenes that really endear me to him more than the kind of the later scenes where it can be a bit too much. It's because of the Christmas setting that it works.
It's kind of like diluted Ribena, not diluted, Ribena cordial, even, where it's just like, in the packet, it's absolutely amazing, but when you get it in the cordial itself and you have to make it at home, it's either too strong or too weak.
And I think the other aspect that makes it work, and this is something that I'll be talking about again later, is there's a really good straight man performance that juxtaposes Buddy in the form of James Caan and, like, Buddy's dad, because he grounds the film to an extent. So his kind of grumpy, grinchy exterior makes Buddy more palatable.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it works.
Of like, how can you be his dad?
Yeah.
He's just sunshine and gumdrops and sugar overload. And there's you.
But it's not just James Caan in that situation. It's like, it's Will Ferrell being the odd one out. Yeah. Like, he's the odd one and everyone else is the straight man. Whereas I think in a lot of Will Ferrell vehicles, everyone is the odd one and there's no straight man to make it seem odd.
Yeah.
So the comedy works because Will Ferrell is being weird as Buddy the Elf and everybody else around him can react to it. Comedy, I can't remember who said that comedy is in the reaction, but that is kind of its basest form, is that Buddy in the film are funny because Buddy is being weird and other people are reacting to it. If everyone in New York was just like Buddy, that film would be really irritating because it'd just be everybody being a weirdo and nobody around to kind of point out how stupid it is. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of basis for comedy in the film.
Yeah.
So what do you have as your number five?
I kind of have a list where it's not entirely in. I have a number one, mm-hmm. very much a number one, and then it's four, not quite in any order.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just gonna go with the one that's like last on the list, and that's The Grinch with Jim Carrey.
Yeah,
it's already mentioned.
Done already.
Yeah, because for me it's that scene where he's in the cave and he's going through his journal where it's just like self-loathing. Oh, I've got dinner with myself. I can't miss that again. And I'm just like, that is me. I relate way too much to The Grinch. I was just like, I'm grumpy, and I'm just like, it's too bright, it's too noisy, I don't know what to wear, nothing fits, and I just don't like people.
I absolutely love that scene where he's picking out outfits to go to the Uno in, and he kind of comes out in everything and just tosses it aside. He comes out in lederhosen and he's like modelling it to the camera. Just sticking his ass out, and then it's just, that's it, I'm not going, the end.
Yeah, and then there's like the dog just sitting there reacting, and I swear that's Adric, that's my cat just watching me trying to get dressed because he's a bit of a perv like that. And it's just like, I don't know what to wear, and it's just like,
there are a few aspects as to why the Grinch works in a lot of ways. There's a few aspects as to how Elf works. And the first one is because of Jim Carrey's performance.
Jim Carrey
absolutely carries that film. He carries that film. It's amazing what he does under all of that prosthetic.
Me again for the final time, the final pickup of this, the final episode of this series. Just to bridge another gap, we were interrupted again by my doorbell again that you heard briefly because I couldn't quite cut it all off but without cutting off my sentence. So this is me saying enjoy the rest of the episode. See you at the end. Bye!
So yeah, Jim Carrey's performance absolutely carries that film, and it's kind of at the height of his powers as well, which helps. Yeah. I was thinking, I think it was 99 or 98, so he was just coming off winning a few Golden Globes. Liar Liar would have been the year before.
Yeah. Those things like The Mask and Ace Ventura.
He had.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ace Ventura, Dumb and Dumber, The Mask. All of that's still fresh in the memory. And then what also sets it apart is the fact that the Grinch is almost justified. He's one of those villains that his grievance makes sense when you look at it from his perspective, but it's because of how he goes about it that we think of him as a villain at the start.
Yeah.
Because he hates Christmas because people were terrible to him. People were assholes to the Grinch, so therefore the Grinch left town. You know, his reason for being bad, quote unquote, are justified, and that's what makes a really good villain.
And then, yeah, it's one of those where it's like, oh, that's completely understandable why he ended up being the way that he is, because people were just being ridiculously mean, and you know, they're carrying on with the whole spirit of Christmas, when in reality the spirit of Christmas, they're not applying that to the Grinch.
Mm.
It's just, yeah, I don't relate to that at all. So it's, oh. And then there's also, like, Cindy Lou Who, just being an absolute...
She's adorable, isn't she?
She's adorable, and I can't remember what the dog's called.
Oh, Max.
Yeah. And just... Those three just make the film everything it is.
Again, it is one of those films like Elf that is perfectly imperfect and only works because of the sentimentality, but also because Jim Carrey really committed to that part. Like, in a way that he had to undergo, like, Navy SEAL torture training just to have the makeup on.
Yeah.
Because he was in the makeup chair for 8 hours a day. Shooting that film,
it was a lot of work, like a lot of prosthetics, and then to do the makeup over that, and the hair, and the entire suit, everything.
Ed, that picture, damn it.
Sorry. Yeah, it was just work of art, complete and utter work of art.
And of course, the design of Whoville and the Whos, that really helps as well, because it's very true to the spirit of Dr. Seuss's work.
Yeah.
It was a very committed adaptation. It's just a shame that the wheels fell off the live-action Dr. Seuss train when The Cat in the Hat was released. And after that release, that was it for Dr. Seuss's widow. She said, that's it. No more live-action adaptations.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. It's like, okay, well, we tried. That's it. We can't. We peaked at the Grinch. We started with the Grinch. We peaked at the Grinch.
Should have quit while we were ahead.
No more attempts to be made.
So moving on, I've got number four, and it's one that has been made a few times over. It's The Nightmare. A Miracle on 34th Street. That's my fourth pick, and it's the 1994 version of Richard Attenborough that I'm picking.
That's my number one.
Oh wow!
All-time Christmas favorite film. I love the 94 version, but I also like the 47 version, but like. Just the 90s version is just everything. I love it so much because it's just everything that Christmas is meant to be about, with the whole thing of like family and, you know, supporting each other. And just there's that cute warm fuzzy thing of just like Mara Wilson being a wee little girl and just being like outsmarting a lawyer with a $1 bill.
I also just think that Richard Attenborough is the most inspired casting as Santa Claus we've probably ever had.
Because he looks so perfect. He is Santa Claus.
He also had that really lovable look. He was just such a lovable looking person that we bought that he was Santa Claus. From the minute we saw him walking with that cane on the sidewalk and the kid looks up to him. And
ask him.
Yeah. It's so lovely. And like, it also helped that this was a film from like my childhood. I remember that my grandma, my dad's mum, really liked, she not only liked this one when it came out, but she also really liked the old one. It was like her favorite, one of her favorite films. I keep saying Nightmare, it's Miracle on 34th Street. It was one of her favorite.
The whole thing of like Nightmare on Elm Street and, you know, Nightmare. Yeah. Christmas, Miracle on 34th. I always get the number wrong. That's part of my dyspraxia, where it's just like, numbers? What? And my brain's just like, no, nothing mathematical. It's like, but it's a title. Nope, it's maths. Out.
And, yeah.
just, but the 40s.
Admittedly, I've never seen the 47 version, but only because I hold the 94 version so near and dear to my heart that I think if I watch the 47 version and it doesn't even remotely add up to it, then it's going to somehow spoil the enjoyment of the 94 version.
I would disagree, and I would like to encourage you to watch the 40s version, because it's like the 90s is like the superior version, because rarely do we ever get a remake that's better than the original.
True, yeah.
But I as much as I feel very like, oh, I don't want to admit, but like the 90s is just chef's kiss.
It really helped that they had Richard Attenborough to cast in that film, because yeah. I think without him it wouldn't have been as good. And of course, Mara Wilson was really good as well.
Yeah.
So that was really nice. I also think I remember the lawyer who's like the mum's boyfriend.
Yeah.
I recognised him, but I can't remember what it was from. But it was quite a strong cast, and obviously it's a well-established story that everyone loved to start with. And it was just giving a story that everyone loved, a really nice cast, and a kind of victory lap, if you like.
I mean, really? It's the kind of reboot that we need to aim for, but we kind of don't.
Well, in some ways, it's it doesn't really work as a remake, because all it did was tell the same story just with a fresh coat of paint, whereas I've always thought a remake or a reboot should tell maybe the same story but in a different way, kind of like what Bradley Cooper did with A Star Is Born. That's a kind of remake, reboot, whatever you want to call it, that can stand on its own. Whereas I think had Miracle been the 94 version been the first one, then that would have been amazing. But because we knew it was working off something, I think people kind of overlook it, which is a shame, because it's a really good film.
So good.
So moving on to your number four then, what have you got?
Yeah. My number four, we've already mentioned Home Alone.
Right.
Yeah. Just, Kevin, how can you forget your son? How? And then it's just the way that he just outsmarts full-grown adults, and you know, he's not entirely clueless, and figures out how to like look after himself, and like when he goes shopping he actually thinks to buy a toothbrush, and it's like, what, how old is he, like 10 or something? I mean, would I have done that at 10? No.
Let's not forget that he definitely murdered those robbers several times over.
I mean, realistically speaking, yes. but they went a bit Looney Tunes with it, and they just did not quit, shall we say?
The thing about Looney Tunes' nature is that
yeah.
it worked.
Yeah.
Because it leaned into its wackiness.
Yeah, and just the way that Kevin keeps like breaking the fourth wall. Like, I forgot how much he breaks the fourth wall, and I was just like, I love this film so much. And just Macaulay Culkin. Oh, and I didn't realise, like, when I rewatched it, I didn't realise his younger brother was in it playing his cousin.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was just like, wait, hang on.
I also forget like, how good Macaulay Culkin was as a kid. And like, as a child actor, he's probably one of the best ever. Yeah. I think the ones I remember most fondly are Macaulay Culkin as Kevin McAllister, and Haley Joel Osment as the kid from The Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
Because I think child actors are they miss a hell of a lot more than they hate the child actors.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, my favourite child actors were like Haley Joel Osment, Macaulay Culkin, Mara Wilson, and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And another double barrel name, Jonathan. He was in Home Improvement.
I do think we have another.
He also played Simba. Jonathan.
Oh yeah. I also
Jonathan Taylor Thomas. There we go.
We've got another good one at the moment with Finn Wolfhard, who's obviously getting a bit older now, but he's really good. And I think we should give a special mention to the Sprouse twins, who were also pretty good when they were kids. But even my top pick for best Christmas film has a really annoying child actor in it. But I don't let it spoil it for me. I'm determined to not let it spoil the movie. But she is very annoying, as most child kind of characters are. They shoot for cuteness and end up with annoying. But that's just kids in general, really, isn't it?
yeah.
So what else do you have to say about Home Alone, then?
I just love it. It's just so ridiculous. But again, with, you know, the warm fuzzies of, like, Kevin going around making friends with the scary neighbour and, you know, the whole life advice thing of just, like, how are you so incredibly young and yet kind of smart? And it's just wholesome, and just the way that, you know, that the mum really tries so hard to get home, and she's just like, oh my god, I can't believe I forgot you. And then it's just the whole thing of, like, his family is awful, though. And again, it's that thing of, like, I relate because, like, my uncle said things to me that no adult should say to a child. And just, like, what the hell were you thinking? like, what adult actually turns around and just scolds a child the way that his uncle does?
Honestly, because I haven't watched it in so long, I've forgotten what happens, but I am going to watch it in the next week. And then it is also worth mentioning also worth mentioning the sequel, which is basically just, let's do the same film again, but set it in New York.
And it kind of works, though, because, again, it's Tim Curry.
There he is again!
He's just a legend, an absolute legend. And, yeah, it's the thing of, like, it's in New York, but it's on a grander scale. It's a bit more elaborate, and, you know, there's, like, Kevin essentially committing credit card fraud.
I
don't know what's happening to my voice at the moment, but yeah.
They also step up the booby traps in the sequel as well. The booby traps get even more devastating. Yeah. If that were ever possible. Like, is it the second one? Is it the first, the second one where he drops an iron on his head?
The first one where he drops an iron, yeah.
Then the second one where he drops him, like, through the floor or something, and they land in the... Yeah.
Yeah.
That kid has committed murder several times over.
Yeah. I mean, if that was any way realistic, it would have been some form of a horror film. Kevin would have.
Don't forget that he also set fire to Joe Pesci. He set Joe Pesci on fire at one point.
Yep. That was pretty amazing, to be honest. Just, I love that.
I also love how, in the space of a year, Joe Pesci went from Goodfellas to Home Alone. That's some range.
I mean, that's range. Yeah.
So what's next on the list? What's next for me? Let's see. Number three, Die Hard. Yes. The best. I'm going to go out on a limb. Best action film ever? Probably. In terms of having a perfect script, I think Die Hard wins out. Because it has a great setup. Its plot progression is well-paced.
Yeah.
The villain is charismatic as all hell. He's hateable, but also likeable. He's hateable, but likeable in the same breath. But also really ruthless as well. Yeah. And then it just has a really nice start, sets everything up, and then a really nice end, which is nice.
And just, did I mention Alan Rickman? I love him. It's one thing having Bruce Willis saying yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, and then Alan Rickman saying it later. I was just like, he actually says this. I love it.
I just think that it's much cooler when Alan Rickman says it than when Bruce Willis said it.
It just sounds so much better, and Yes. But it's also the thing with like the is it Hans? Yeah, Hans, where Miss Gennaro anyways, it's just like, oh, we've got a pregnant lady here and you know she can't keep sitting on the floor. Can we change her to a different room so she can sit on a couch? And he's just like, no. But I'll get a sofa brought up to her. I'm like, I'm not a complete monster. Like, yes, I'm a homicidal maniac, but I have manners.
That actually, now you point it out, reminds me of Harry in Bruges when he's like trying to get past the hotel owner near the end, but he won't like hit her or shoot her because she's pregnant.
Yeah. It's like that scene from Deadpool where it's where he's where there's like the two women where it's just like, is it sexist if I hit you? Is it sexist if I don't? And he gets attacked and it's just like, oh, manners.
It's a there are a few like movies that are taught in some film schools as like being a perfect screenplay. Back to the Future is one of them because of the way it's constructed. It's a perfect construction of a screenplay, and I think Die Hard is similar because it has a perfect ramping up of the stakes and then a descent into the success. Also some really good action set pieces, like for instance the walking across glass, the shootout in the abandoned offices, the bit where he swings down on that hose as the rooftop explodes,
Yeah.
that bit.
That's just
That's
amazing.
some ridiculously great action set pieces and like a coherent story that you can follow and understand easily.
But like with the script and the storyline, it's like he's a policeman from, what was it, New York going to LA.
Yeah.
And it's like things are happening. He calls the police and they're just not doing their job. They're just like, okay, if you say so, sir. Just like, no, we definitely need police here. There's things happening. And then at one point where he says, I'm not ordering a fucking pizza, lady. I'm like, oh my God.
But the other thing to love about Die Hard is endlessly quotable. There's
It is.
"Welcome to the party, pal," which is one of my first favorites. And then there's a "Now I have a shotgun." Ho, ho, ho. Which is just delivered perfectly. There's obviously Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, which is in every film, which is in every one of the series. It's one of those that it has longevity because of it, how it sticks in public consciousness because of the quotability, because of how memorable it
Yeah. And
is.
just
And
the casting.
of course it's perfectly casted, and it's a perfect setup and a great script.
Yeah.
And that's all you really need to say about it. And also the first two sequels are really good, and the last two sequels suck.
I haven't watched the sequels yet. I've watched the first one. I've not got round to the sequels yet.
The second one is also set at Christmas, and the third one is not, but is
Oh.
probably my favourite after the first one, because it has Samuel L. Jackson being really cool and Jeremy Irons playing Hans Gruber's brother, so that's nice.
Oh, I can see that. That is, oh, the casting. Hello. I can totally see Jeremy Irons being Alan Rickman's brother.
So watch up to Die Hard with a Vengeance, and then forget the rest of the series. Then just
Yeah, let's
pretend
just not exist. Like,
it.
whatever.
So what's your number three then? What have you got for number three?
Because I've switched things out, haven't I? Because you mentioned Miracle on 34th Street, so I'm just like, I'm lost. So I've mentioned The Grinch. I've mentioned Home Alone.
Yep.
That leaves me with Rise of the Guardians.
Oh. See, I've never seen this. I know of it. It's the animated film where there's like Jack Frost and the Easter Bunnies in it and things
Yeah.
like that. I've never actually seen it. Is
Hugh
the Grinch
Jackman as
concept?
the Easter Bunny.
Okay, that's brilliant.
And he's just like he's got his Australian accent as well, and it's just like it works. It's just one of those things where it's just like, what is happening?
There
And
are
yeah, it's
so few films in which Hugh Jackman can use his Australian accent, and it's a big missed opportunity.
I was just, again, it's one of those stories where it's like warm fuzzies because Jack's just being Jack and adorable, and the whole, you know, backstory where he's trying to save his sister and it doesn't go to plan, and now he's just trying to save the world from evil.
It's a very kind of mythical story, isn't it? It's kind of a story of all the kind of mythical beings, if you like.
Yeah.
Although I've never actually seen it. It's a DreamWorks film, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Which are up and down, shall we say.
Mm.
They have peaks and troughs.
Yeah.
Very high peaks and very low troughs.
Oh, well, yeah.
So, at this kind of halfway point, I'd also like to talk about, like, films that aren't Christmas films but always get played at Christmas. So the one that I think of when I think of that is Mary Poppins. Like, it's not a Christmas film, but it's always played at Christmas. And to add to that, Mary Poppins Returns, which I like just as much as the original.
Hmm.
Have you seen Mary Poppins Returns?
I have. I thought it was... It's a good film, but it's I enjoyed it, but there was parts with Emily Blunt's Mary Poppins that didn't quite align with Julie Andrews.
I think there was a lot more
the character inspired by, and there's just few things where it's just like Julie wouldn't have done that.
There's a lot of noise made in the run-up to release that said her Emily Blunt's Mary Poppins is a lot closer to the book version than Julie Andrews' version. Although, yeah, of course, Julie Andrews is the kind of example there to follow. I think Emily Blunt did a great job at being Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
And I certainly wouldn't say no to seeing her play the part again. And I certainly wouldn't say no to seeing Marlin Manuel Miranda, because Marlin, please.
Just yes.
Give me all the Lynn.
I would like to co-sign this.
And also, it had a really nice soundtrack, which is like, but it had this kind of soundtrack that captured the spirit of the originals without feeling dated. Like it did big because it had elements of Lin-Manuel being Lin-Manuel. It had like a little rap bit in it. It felt like it was transplanting the formula that made Mary Poppins a wonderful film in the 1960s and put it into the 2010s and made it still as wonderful. And then just to put the glacé cherry on top of the trifle, Dick Van Dyke came back at the end, which was chef's kiss. But not only Dick Van Dyke, but Angela Lansbury as the balloon lady, little lady.
Yeah. Oh, I was so happy.
Be still, my beating gay heart, for Angela Lansbury.
Right, just bowed out to the Queen. Although Julie Andrews is also the Queen, but it's just like we have two queens. Yes.
That part was originally intended for Julie Andrews, but but she wouldn't be in it because she didn't want to steal Emily Blunt's thunder, which is lovely.
Which is because... so Julie Andrews, though.
Yeah, that's it so... is, isn't it? It's so lovely.
Yeah.
But you can kind of see in the film that part was supposed to be played by Julie Andrews because of certain lines in it. That it's kind of suggesting that the balloon lady is magical too.
Yeah.
But if you can't get Julie Andrews, Angela Lansbury is not a bad substitute. You know.
I wouldn't say substitute, but like
equal.
Yes. Yeah. This is where I'm just like, don't make me fight.
then there's also The Sound of Music is always on at Christmas.
Yes.
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is always on at Christmas.
Yeah.
Again, Dick Van Dyke.
There's a theme.
Christmas should just be sponsored by Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke. They're just the two kind of marshals of Christmas. And I love that in Mary Poppins Returns, Dick Van Dyke was tap dancing at the age of like 93 or whatever he was at the time of filming. That was wonderful. I really love those kind of nostalgia films that don't wallow too much in nostalgia, but have a moment where they can let themselves kind of be fans of their own property in a way. Like it was clear that Dick Van Dyke's appearance was mainly because the filmmakers wanted to tie it to the original one, and they really wanted Dick Van Dyke to come back. Mm. But in a key bit of information, they didn't make him use his Cockney accent, which is probably for the best.
Yes.
Because Dick Van Dyke in his prime couldn't do a Cockney accent, so Dick Van Dyke in his 90s, God knows what would have happened.
See, growing up, I never realised that was meant to be a British accent. I didn't know what accent it was supposed to be, but I knew it wasn't British. And then, you know, moving over here and people are just like, oh my God, his Cockney accent is awful. And I'm just like, that was meant to be Cockney?
There's a story about the origins of the accent, as it were. He had a dialect coach that was Irish, whose Cockney accent was worse than Dick Van Dyke's, apparently. So that's why Dick Van Dyke's is so bad.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
I can just imagine that his dialect coach was just some chancer from Dublin who answered an ad for a dialect coach and had no experience. He was just on his way back home from the pub and saw it on a lamppost or something.
Yeah.
But, all right, I'll give that a try.
This is my best chance.
This is my chance to break into show business.
And
there's a little example of my own acting range there with my Irish accent. I am available to hire for acting gigs, weddings, holidays, bar mitzvahs. Slide into my DMs. let's get back to our list then. And I'm going to go with my number two, which is one that I watched and reviewed the other week. It's one of my favourite films. It gives me the warm fuzzies every time I watch it. It's The Muppets Christmas Carol.
That's my number two.
God, do I love The Muppets Christmas Carol. Oh, yes. It's so good.
And it's so close to the book source. Sorry, I'm glitching because I'm just like, I can't believe we've got the same film. But yeah, it's close to the actual book. It's as far as adaptations go, it's pretty close to the original, and it's just but with Muppets.
It's unbelievable because it's, as you say, it's a great adaptation and it's a great use of the Muppets. The Muppets make everything better, let's face it.
Yes.
I'm starting a campaign here and now for actually I'll mention that later because it's my number one film, but I just want more Muppets in Christmas films. Is that too much to ask? But again, and I mentioned this in my review, that there's a big reason why Muppets Christmas Carol works, and that is because Michael Caine plays it as if he's in a Shakespearean production, and it's wonderful.
He's just so serious.
He would have so serious. Yeah, but that's
talking to a Muppet.
That was his kind of his condition for accepting the role, was that he would he wouldn't act as if he was acting with Muppets. He would play it as straight as possible. He is a really good Ebenezer Scrooge, even though he is playing opposite Muppets. It is one of the best adaptations of the story to begin with, and it's probably the best Muppets. I'm always torn because I really love the Muppets, and I don't think there's been a bad Muppets film at all. There's been a few that have been worse than others, but I think in terms of the best, Christmas Carol has to be up there. The 2011 The Muppets, that was really good as well, as was the original The Muppets movie. But it is it's such a perfect Christmas film. The performances, it gives you the Christmassy feels. The soundtrack is wonderful. I always go away from the film humming one of the tunes, if not several tunes, back to back. The performance of the puppets are wonderful. There's something so uniquely great about Jim Henson's puppet work. Something that like inhabits all of the film, all of the properties under the Jim Henson umbrella. They do puppetry like no other place does puppetry. Like they bring the characters to life in a way that most puppeteers, like I trained in puppeteering when I did Avenue Q years ago with Nigel Plaskett, who there's a clanging name drop for you, who worked with Jim Henson on some Muppets films. And you could tell, like, as soon as he picks up a puppet, that puppet was alive. Like,
yeah.
He must have just taught a way of handling puppets and making them come to life in a way that few people can replicate.
Because, yeah, the thing with Jim Henson is that there is that element of believable realism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know it's not real, but it could. It could be.
Like, I think Tiny Tim is as effective in this film when he's a little frog than he is in any other adaptation. I know that I watched it the other week, and I must have watched it 10 times, if not more, and still that scene after they come back from the church and they're sitting down for Christmas dinner and the Ghost of Christmas Present's there with Scrooge and Tiny Tim's talking, it still makes me well up. Yeah. And it's a little frog. It's a frog puppet.
It's just fabric and wire, and yet reduces you to tears.
It felt, and it's the most heartfelt thing ever.
Yeah.
But I think that's in it. That's what's in it. It's the Muppets are just all heart. They come from the heart. They come from a squishy place of love and hugs, and taking this kind of story. I'm welling up talking about it now. It's weird. Stop it, Ed.
It's literal warm fuzzies from actual warm fuzzies.
This story that's been retold and retold can still kind of be given a new lease of life and can still touch your heart, even though most of the things in it are made of felt and wire. And
yeah.
Like, and because they're so Muppet-like, the performance of Michael Caine just playing it straight as Scrooge becomes even more perfect, because you don't need someone to be wild and crazy when you're playing opposite the Muppets, because they do all the legwork.
Yeah, yeah. Even though they kind of don't have actual legs.
Yeah, well. they do the legwork without having legs. That's impressive. Yeah. And also, I think there has to be something to be said about how they hand what puppet they gave what part to, like what character they gave which part to, because all of that was perfect too. Like making the Marleys twins and giving it to Statler and Waldorf. Perfect.
Oh my goodness, that was yeah.
There were no other Muppets that could have done that, and just like making Kermit Bob Cratchit, because he's the kind of the beating heart of the story, if you like, and Kermit is just engrossing and endearing, and he's the beating heart of the Muppets. That makes it work. And like all the peripheral characters that get a B-Care as the charity collector, and another moment that makes your heart swell, and it's just like B-Care giving Scrooge a scarf, and it makes you well up. And this is B-Care, a character that just goes me 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 meep, and like him giving someone a scarf can make you well up.
Right.
just how well dillied out these parts were to make this work, this silly gang of puppets doing a 200-year-old story, and it's so effective. And I'm genuinely emotional talking about
it. Right? It's just one of those films where it's like, if anybody else tried to do a puppet version of, you know, Christmas Carol, because like one of my honourable mentions was Mickey's Christmas Carol, and it doesn't hit the same way that the Muppets does, as much as I love Disney.
Yeah.
The Muppets are the superiors here.
Would that have been Mickey Mouse as Scrooge, or was it Scrooge McDuck as Scrooge?
I think it was Scrooge McDuck, yeah.
No, if it had been Mickey Mouse as Scrooge, then I wouldn't have bought it at all.
Yeah, because it's just like, he's too wholesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you have as your number two choice before we move on to our top pick?
We already
know yours, but
yeah, because there was number five was Grinch, Four was Home Alone, three Rise of the Guardians, and two is Muppet Christmas Carol.
Oh wow. Well,
yeah.
Twinsies.
Because we had like similar ones and we'd mentioned same ones. Yeah. And it was just like, but that's my number, whatever. So it's mine's the best. So yeah, and then I'd already mentioned my number one.
Miracle on 34th Street.
Yeah.
So do you have anything else to say on the Muppets Christmas Carol that I haven't already covered?
I think that's about it, actually. Just, everything Christmas Carol, just the sets as well.
The sets and how they're adapted. Yeah. I've always found it, like, genius how they adapt sets to the Muppets. Because, like, the swamp set in the Muppet movie, the original, was kind of built on a little scaffolding so Jim Henson could be underneath the log. And, like, all of this was Jim Henson's kind of ideas. All of it came from his ideas, how to build the sets, how to make everything work with the puppets. Was his brain, and like he came up with all this, and
absolute genius.
Yeah, and while we were talking about it earlier, I also really love the puppet of Hoggle in Labyrinth. But that's a conversation for another time, because I'm going to hit you with my number one pick, and this is the one I think needs remaking with puppets. It's my million with Muppets. It's my $1 million Hollywood pitch, and it's Muppets. It's a Wonderful Life. That's my number one pick.
I don't know if I've actually seen that. Is that? It's a Wonderful Life.
It's the James Stewart one from 1947. It's the quintessential Christmas film.
Because it is one that keeps getting mentioned where it is the Christmas. Because another one is like White Christmas.
Yeah, and when I did,
don't think I've seen Christmas in like years. But
when I did a podcast with one of our lecturers, James Zabrowski, he named this film as one of his favorite films of all time. And basically, like, described it as a perfect film, and I agree with him. It is, for all intents and purposes, it's the template of a Christmas film. It's dark, and it's surprisingly dark, and takes a long time to get to the crux of the issue. But basically, the story is about George Bailey, who's a kind of middle class American guy, runs his late father's savings and loan business. He has a really bad couple of days leading up to Christmas. And like the film revolves around this point in the middle of the film where he's on a bridge and he's praying to God because he's thinking about committing suicide and jumping off the bridge. And and he sent a guardian angel, Clarence, who is a angel second class because he doesn't have his wings. And basically the angel shows him what the world would be like if he hadn't been born, and again, I'm welling up, I'm getting emotional because it's one of the most, it's an emotional story because it shows him all the differences a human makes that they don't realize they make in the course of their life. Like the film starts with a kind of a mini recap of George's life leading up to adulthood. So he saves his brother from drowning at the start. So obviously when he's not born, his brother drowns. So his brother dies and his mother and father are heartbroken. He also stops a pharmacist who he worked for putting cyanide in some pills because the pharmacist was told that his son had died in war, and he got so drunk that he put cyanide in these pills, and George stops him from putting cyanide in these pills. So he stops these pills getting out, and because he wasn't born, those cyanide pills go out and like kill a few kids, and this pharmacist goes to prison, and then without him, his children aren't born. His wife becomes like a maiden. She doesn't get married. She works in a library. She's lonely. She's sad, and like she's being pursued by someone who George doesn't like. And it's basically a story of all of the lives that one human being touches that they don't realise. And by the end, it's just this massive life-affirming scene where he's got his life back. People recognise him again, and it's Christmas, and he's running down the main street, and he's shouting Merry Christmas to every building, and he's waving at people. Merry Christmas, you old savings and loan. Merry Christmas, Bedford Falls. And it's one of the most iconic movie scenes in history. It's a wonderful film. And I watch it every year, and every year it makes me cry. And it's one of my favourite films. I love it so, so much. I'm going to write a review of it. I'm going to write a review of it in the next few weeks. And I don't know how I'm going to put into words how much I love this film. I don't know how to properly describe my feelings towards it, other than to just put like 1,000 crying face emojis and just call it a day, because that's it. Like, it's a perfect story of a person's life. It tells it from like him being a kid through all the key events to adulthood, to him having kids, and like the ending is so life affirming and heartwarming. And God, I love it so much.
I need to find that, because it sounds it just sounds like really just a very Christmas, like warm and fuzzy, emotional, uplifting, just everything you need at this time of year kind of thing.
And there's also a kind of a nice story behind it too, in that James Stewart, the leading man, who's obviously a Hollywood icon of the golden age, he was a kind of personal career low when that film came out, because he'd just come back from the Second World War. And of course, he would have been suffering from kind of PTSD and what have you. And that part was kind of what brought him back. And what he's, I think he'd said a few times, it was one of the parts he was most proud of. And you can really see why, in the same way that Michael Caine says that he's most proud of Muppet's Christmas Carol, as mad as that is. It's for the career Michael Caine's had, but it's one of those films that you would be kind of, it would be like the pride of your life to be part of it, because it's just one of those films that is perfect.
Oh my goodness.
Cool. But and as I say, my $1 million Hollywood pitch is to remake the film with Muppets.
Apparently there's going to be like a, not a remake, but like a table read this year of It's a Wonderful Life. Pete Davidson is doing... I think the news came out like 3 weeks ago or something.
I've never really seen Pete Davidson in anything to know what I think of him really.
I know of him, and the things that I know of him, I'm not really impressed, but it's like secondhand information. So it's like, I'm trying to remain indifferent and just like, okay, well, whatever. I've not seen anything directly, so none of my business. If I don't see it, it's not that kind of thing, I guess. But I don't know how. It's like, I'm not going to go deep into it, I guess.
Yeah, I think it would have
so much drama. So much drama. I don't have the energy to.
It would have a great impact if it was remade with Muppets, in the same way that Christmas Carol did. Like, you can cast a human as George Bailey and like most of the other parts as Muppets, and it would hit the same way as Christmas Carol, I think.
I've not seen it, but already I'm just like, I will coincide this. I want it. Yeah. I have to watch the original, but I already want the Muppet version.
I can just imagine Kermit as the guardian angel. And there's like a really like rich like bank manager character that wants to foreclose on the savings and loan. And I'm just trying to think you'd probably have like, that'd be two, and have Statler and Waldorf as that character. Yeah,
just have the Waldorfs do it.
Yeah. But honestly, words couldn't do justice to how great it is. And I would be backed up by this on by James Zabrowski if you ever get to talk to him about it, because he's a fan of it too. And as I think most film film critics are a fan of It's a Wonderful Life, to be fair.
But it's also one of those things of if like James has said that it's a good film, then I'm gonna believe him, basically. So it's one of those things of like, okay, there's certain stamps of approval. I'm not gonna waste any more time. I'm watching it tonight.
I think
if I have to buy it, I think it's one of those things of like, you know what? You just say it's good, I'm buying it.
It says a lot about a film that it was made in 1948 and it still hasn't been remade because nobody dare remake it. I think that
great films that have been remade when it really doesn't remake. So that does actually say a lot.
I think that says more about it than any critic can ever say. Because in this world of remaking everything that could possibly make money, not a film because it's already perfect is what, and the thing is it's not that like they want it to be forgotten because they re-release it every year. Like there was a 4K re-release this year, so
isn't there a color edited version?
I would recommend you watch it in black and white though, because it's that's how it's meant to be seen. But again, it gets a re-release on like Blu-ray and 4K. So like the people who own the pair strings don't want you to forget about it, which says to me that they're not intending to remake it at any point soon. Because if they were, they would stop re-releasing it. So like if I was, there were certain films that as a director, you would just never want to touch. You would never want to go near a remake of. I think that's one. The Godfather's another. Citizen Kane's probably another. Citizen Kane's even older than It's a Wonderful Life, and that hasn't been remade. So,
how would you remake Citizen Kane, though? I mean, it's that kind of a film where it's just like, how could that actually be remade?
And I think it's very much the same as It's a Wonderful Life, is that no one wants to remake it because no one can see a way of making it any better.
Yeah.
And if you... And that's kind of the point of a remake. If you can't see a way of making it better, then there's no point in trying, is there? Just so reminding people like that exist.
Updating the story, but then does that need remaking?
Timeless. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't need a fresh coat of paint because the coat of paint that's already applied. It still looks fresh.
But then there's some things where it's like, even if they do age, it still doesn't need any adaption. You know, like antiques kind of thing?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, this is in mint condition. It's an antique, but it's in mint condition.
And that's the thing is, it doesn't age. Like, some of the things, like, look a little bit, like, old now. Like, I think there's a big play around him losing like $6,000, which in today's money isn't as much as it would have been back then. But that's really the only way it's aged. And this is the one that I was talking about earlier when there's a really annoying child actor in it. And it's one of George Bailey's daughters who's, I don't know whether you've ever heard this clip before, but it's in like a lot of Christmas clip shows. It's like, teacher says, whenever a bell rings, an angel gets its wings. Yeah, that's from It's a Wonderful Life, and that's the child actress that really annoys me. But she still doesn't take any of the shine off it. it would take a million annoying child actors to take the shine off it. And there's actually, credit where credit's due, a couple of really good child actors in it too, especially the one that plays George Bailey when he's a kid. He's really good.
Yeah.
But honestly, there's no more words I can say. Just go and watch it. Watch it tonight. Let me know what you think. And everyone that's listening, watch it over Christmas. You'll thank me after you've watched it. I promise. It's good. It's really good. So I think that kind of brings to a conclusion our chat for today, Angel. Unless there's anything else you want to say on Miracle on 34th Street.
No, I'm pretty much all talked out on Miracle on 34th Street.
Right. So We've had a real blast talking about Christmas films. I think this is probably one of my favourite recordings I've done thus far. Me and Angel are going to go on a bit of a hiatus from the podcast after this episode because we've both got a dissertation to write. So that's going to be time-consuming, AF, as I think the kids say.
I refer to it as assignment hell.
Assignment hell.
Yes. It's just like, okay, let's go down to the ninth realm of assignment hell. And
oh. So that's going to be very time-consuming, and we thought that ending it on a Christmas special, if you like, would be a nice way to bookmark what has been a kind of very transformative series of the podcast. Obviously, when I started this out, I was a kind of podcasting nomad. I just kind of pulled in anyone I could, and to have someone as a permanent co-host has been a really big help. So I need to thank Angel for their co-hosting and for their chats over the past kind of 6 months we've been doing this. Thanks a lot, Angel, for being with me.
Oh, stop, you're making me cry.
And
I don't like these warm, fuzzy feelings. Let me leave it to the films.
And it said on that day,
it's been on
that day, Angel's heart did grow 3 sizes that day.
It's unbearable. Oh my goodness, but it's been a lot of fun, and I've learned a lot of new things and seen new films. It's been a pretty great adventure.
And I hope that you can join me again when we start back up in April, May time, later in 2021.
Yeah.
That would be really good. So we'll be back in 2021. Maybe with a new lick of paint, maybe we'll just be the same kind of tangential loving podcast host as we always been. As a kind of end to the podcast, I would like to deliver a little Christmas message, as it were. So think of this not a Christmas message from the Queen, but a message from a Queen. So, obviously, this year has been very hard for everyone. Obviously, we've all been shut in our homes. A lot of people have died. A lot of people have got really sick. And one thing that's kind of kept us all sane in a lot of ways is watching entertainment, watching films, watching TV. At this time, it's more important than ever to kind of be with each other in whatever form that is. So I hope that whatever you're doing this Christmas, you're with people that you love in whatever form you can be, that you're keeping safe to make sure that people around you stay out of hospital, stay ill, stay alive. And just remember that what helped us through this crisis was not politicians making decisions. It wasn't kind of people who think they're important. But what kept us sane is what we've watched, what we've read, and what we will continue to read and watch. So I'd like you to bear in mind over this Christmas period, the hundreds, if not thousands, of artists who have been out of work for coming up to a year, and who will continue to be out of work as the situation kind of comes to its end. It's obviously been a difficult period for cinema. It's been a difficult period for theatre. And although we will come through it, we might not come through it looking the same as it once was. And maybe some of that is for the best. And I would like to thank everyone that I encountered in a cinema during its brief reopening in the summer for their hospitality, their hard work, and their passion for their work. Because I know that speaking to a few friends of mine who work at a cinema, that they really have a passion for doing what they do, for bringing films to people. So remember that when you next go to a cinema, how much of an honour that is, and how much you enjoy it, how much these people are working very hard to keep you all safe. And As always, at this time of year, there will be a lot of people on their own, through their own choice or otherwise. I would just like to say that my thoughts are with you all. I'd like to think that nobody in my immediate circle would ever be truly alone at Christmas, because most of them have my phone number. And I'd like to take this opportunity, as I always, at any point in time, to remind you that Black Lives Matter, that trans lives matter, and that you're not alone. And most importantly and finally, fuck Donald Trump. Thank you all, and Merry Christmas, and we'll see you in 2021.
Hello, everyone. That was the end of a wonderful recording. I really had fun recording that. And just as a kind of addendum to the end of my incredibly long and a little bit preachy spiel at the end, I just wanted to add in a few pointers at the end, with this being the season of giving and all of that. I thought it'd be nice, as we did in kind of the first episode of this series, we added some links into some Black Lives Matter related charities. I thought it would be nice, this being Christmas, for me to drop in a couple of plugs for some charities that could really do with the help, as always, around Christmas. The first one is the Trussell Trust. These are all UK charities, by the way, because I'm UK based. I'm sorry if you're listening in America, but I don't know many of your charities. If you do, please go onto Google and find some similar ones. The first one I'd like to mention in the UK is the Trussell Trust, which is a food bank charity. A lot of people will be going without as much food as the rest of us have at Christmas. It's particularly a hard time to be low on funds. So if you go and give a look at what the Trussell Fund are doing. Secondly, I'd like to give a mention to Mermaids, the trans charity that myself and Angel would like to mention, as Mermaids is the kind of go-to trans charity in the UK. Obviously, there will be some you might want to donate to in your local area, whether there's a local fund. I understand the want and the need to keep charity a more local endeavour, so please do give if you can. And finally, I would just like to first send out thanks to my first patron on my Patreon page, which can be found via my website. I'd like to give a shout out to my friend Ian Judson, a gentleman and a scholar. He sends me films to review. He's been keeping me sane these past few months. I'd like to give a special shout out to the charity he's involved with, which is particularly important in my local, in my former local area, I should say, as I don't live there anymore. But it's the Jack Harrison VC statue campaign, based around the former rugby league player, played for Hull FC. He's a Victoria Cross recipient, was sadly lost in the Great War at the start of the 20th century. Ian is highly involved with fundraising to do with the Jack Harrison VC statue campaign. So you can go to Facebook and search for Jack Harrison statue. Jack Harrison VC statue campaign, and check out all the stuff that they're doing. It's a very good cause to get a memorial to a real hero of a terrible, terrible conflict. But apart from that, I'd just like to echo the sentiments I made in my speech towards the end. I wish you all a very happy and healthy Christmas and a prosperous new year. And myself and Angel will look forward to talking to you again at some point in 2021. See you soon. Have a good one. Stay safe as well, above all, and keep each other safe. Bye.